I'm Lisa Heineman, co-host of New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies. Let's talk about failure, stupidity, forgetting, repeating the same mistake over and over, lacking discipline. That's what Judith Jack Halberstam wants us to do. Failure, she says, might just be one of the smartest responses to the constraining imperatives of success. If, that is, we could sneak free of heteronormative and capitalist definitions of what's smart. In her new book, The Queer Art of Failure, published by Duke University Press in 2011, Halberstam explores failure in film, literature, photography, high art, low theory. There's a light side to all of this, as adorable animated creatures create loopy, unsuccessful worlds. And there's a darker side, as feminists, queers, and post-colonial subjects face the limits of failure as well as success. Jack Halberstam is professor of English, gender studies, and American studies and ethnicity at the University of Southern California. And she's the author of such classics as Female Masculinity, as well as the forthcoming Gaga Feminism. Let's hear from her. I have with me Jack Halberstam, whose recent book is The Queer Art of Failure with Duke University Press. And she's going to talk to us today about that book. Very happy to have her on the program. Jack, let me ask you to start out by just telling us a little bit about your background. How did you get into queer studies? How did you get into this line of work? Where have you been up till now?
Okay, well, wow, that would be a long period to cover. But basically, I got into queer studies the same way a lot of people of my generation did, which was in a kind of casual way. I wasn't trained in queer theory. I was a grad student right when queer theory was beginning, early 90s. And when I got my first job at UC San Diego, they hired me both as sort of 19th and 20th century lit person, but they also made it clear to me that they were interested if I wanted to pursue some of the new queer work that was coming out and teach classes and some of these topics. And so I sort of trained myself, and I got really interested in queer studies and went to the big queer studies conferences that happened around that time at Rutgers and Iowa, in fact, and other places, and realized that this was just a great place for me to set up my little anti-disciplinary, interdisciplinary shop and find a few exit routes from conventional literary study. And I'm not one of those people who has wished that queer studies would become a discipline or that it would have permanent homes and that it would settle down and become something real. I like the kind of contingent feeling, the improvised feeling of queer studies. And that's in a way what I try to convey to students who study with me now.
Wonderful. So now you have a brand new book called The Queer Art of Failure. And I'd love to just ask you, what is The Queer Art of Failure?
Yeah, well, I began writing this book after I was asked by a fabulous lesbian art group called LTTR, which sometimes stands for Lesbians to the Rescue, but can stand for pretty much whatever you want. They asked me to participate in around 2004 in two different events, one in New York City and one in LA, under the heading of Practice More Failure. And I was sort of stumped by this heading for a while, but it was the year of the 2004 Olympics, and there was so much success and failure in abundance on the TV that I felt very inspired by this idea of practicing failure. And given the context of the Olympics, I realized that in a way, failure was a kind of anti-nationalist, anti-capitalist, anti-normative kind of pursuit. And I tried to frame an endorsement of failure at these events in terms of both the Olympic Games with its emphasis on winning and winners, and in terms of a queer practice of failing in order to critique the terms of success. And so that beginning sort of unfolded into a much bigger project about the politics of failure, and then dovetailed with our most recent economic collapse, and then became, to me, it seems like a really, really urgent topic to talk about in an age where the coordinates of success have become so scrambled and crazy and get crazier by the minute.
You know, in some ways, your book is a kind of celebration of failure, right? Why is that? What's so great about failure? And as you suggest, it's a critique of the terms of success.
Yeah.
Tell us about success. Tell us about failure. Why do we want to celebrate failure?
Well, I'm celebrating failure really as a kind of conceptual tool, such that if we measure success in terms of profits, the accumulation of wealth, and the conformity to certain predetermined norms of within heterosexual reproductivity, then failure is going to represent an opting out of those kinds of measurements of, you know, social participation and value. And so it seems to me that within failure is embedded a very fierce critique of what passes for inevitable and natural in the cultures that we live in. And I was looking for a rubric that would allow me to tie some of the queer critiques of normativity to some sort of lefty anarchist critiques of capital, and then to a sort of, you know, obsession with professionalization in middle-class culture. And, you know, often queer studies and particularly the study of political economies are held apart. And by no means is my book, can anyone construe it as a book in political economy. But at the same time, it does recognize that through the rubric of failure, you can tie queer critiques of normativity to socialist critiques of capital. And that's in a way the value of it. You're right that it is a celebration of failure, but at the same time, the book goes to some dark places. It doesn't say that failure is all fun and games, and that as soon as you give up on success, you're in the realm of, you know, the free and the ludic and the impossibly fabulous or anything like that. It's more that failure in the end has more to offer us in terms of thinking about alternatives to the current way in which we live life in the US and in Europe than success does. Success represents conformity, and it represents acceding to and consenting to these social norms. And failure represents a real desire to trouble them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's absolutely right that in some ways the book, you know, starts out as a critique of success and the suggestion that failure is perhaps a wise alternative in some cases, but it does move to a kind of some more sobering considerations.
Yes.
But let's start with some of the more fun stuff.
Yeah.
In the first part of the book, especially, animated film plays a very large role.
Yeah.
And you have a lot to say about why particularly CGI, computer-generated imagery, 3D films like Toy Story, like Chicken Run, you know, some of the real blockbusters, you see these as falling very much into your critique of success and a kind of queering of failure. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, you know, when I started doing this work, I would use animated films as little funny, whimsical illustrations of this or that that I was trying to argue for or against. And at a certain point, I realized, well, this is wrong, really, to just take a little clip from Finding Nemo or a little clip from Monsters or Robots and use it to make a funny point. Because actually, the more that I look at these animated films, the more that I find that they seem to be inscribing different narratives into their, you know, animated universes than the ones that we would expect to find in high profit material that is geared towards children. So the common wisdom is that animated films sell children on family and heterosexual romance and free enterprise. But actually, nothing could be further from the truth. And there are a number of different reasons for that, some of which are sort of to do with the technology of CGI. And some of them have to do with the fact that children are complex viewers, and they're not going to be seduced by the same things that adults are seduced by. And I think that increasingly in a marketplace absolutely jam-packed and crowded with material that is vying for the child's attention, because children are very lucrative viewers because they watch things over and over and over again. The CGI films managed to capture a different part of the child market. And they did so partly by improving on the technology, but also partly by understanding that when children watch films, they're not looking for stories of romance or moral tales about family or, you know, sincere sort of appreciations of the status quo. Children are anarchic little creatures, and they're as engaged with rebellion, disorder, with upset, with alternatives as they are with the norms and the status quo. If children were already normative, we wouldn't devote such massive amounts of time and energy to training them to be normal. So these cartoons have to appeal to the children both where they live in their little anarchic world, but also try to train them for something else. And that's where it gets interesting. Now, in terms of the technology, what I try to explain in the book is that CGI came up with all of these different algorithms for representing complexity, visual and narrative complexity. And so in some of the early films, just as an example, Pixar came up with the algorithm for representing crowds, masses of little creatures. So whereas in linear animation, you might have had to hand draw the same creature over and over again to represent a mass or a multitude, in the new CGI, there's an algorithm for representing the diversity and complexity of the crowd. So once you have that very expensive algorithm figured out, you're now kind of committed to narratives that feature crowds and multitudes. And so we end up with a bunch of these films that are about social insects and that are oriented to narratives about the many against the few, the 99% against the 1%, if you like. And so we end up with semi-socialist, quite anarchistic, beautiful stories about how important it is to go along with the community rather than just doing your own thing. And that then leads to a sort of rebellion against that in like Happy Feet, where the individual has to make a stand for his own uniqueness. But the early films are very, very much about community, cooperation, and a sort of anarchist sense that we can build a world by finding our commonalities and building across different species and finding common ground. So you end up with these kind of radical, amazing narratives about rebellion, about multitudes, and about perverse little creatures looking for a better world. And so that was a real revelation to me and opened me up to this whole new universe of representation.
So can you talk us through a couple of examples of this, or at least one, about, you know, films that we might be familiar with?
Yeah.
Of course, these are by and large blockbuster films, right?
Right.
Many of us have seen them. Tell us your take on something like, and particularly this thread of community and cooperation,
yeah,
over the power of the individual. Or you also note the sort of internalness of the family,
yeah,
right? The sort of notion of the large community rather than the family.
Yeah.
How does that work out in your view in an example, in one or two of the films that you particularly liked?
Well, the one that really got me going on all of this was Finding Nemo, which I thought was going to be just kind of cute and funny. And then I watched it and I was like, I was blown away. I was blown away, first of all, by its beauty. And the algorithm that they developed in Finding Nemo was the algorithm for light on water, which is such an interesting thing to think about how to represent in an animated film. But if you watch the film looking at light on water, you realize that many different shades of emotion are conveyed that way. But I thought at first I was like, oh, this is the usual. The mother dies in the first few minutes. We're back to kind of Disney, the absent mother. The father-son bond seems to be foregrounded. And after, you know, Nemo disobeys his father, the paternal imperative, he swims off into the ocean and gets scooped up by the fishermen, at which point the father now realizes that he has to go in search of his son. So it seems like a very patriarchal quest narrative. But because we then get this crazy, loopy, queer fish, Dory, played by Ellen DeGeneres, swimming in to help Marlin find his son, the whole thing goes haywire. And from then on, it's all about cooperation among the different species that live under the ocean. And they're all helping to find Nemo. But meanwhile, Nemo he's not thinking, oh, how can I get back to my dad? He's also learning important lessons in captivity in a fishbowl, where he learns from an old convict in the fishbowl how to swim against the fishermen's nets. And this comes up at the end of the film, where the climax is not finding Nemo. The climax is Nemo, Marlin, and Dory uniting together to exhort the fish who are being scooped up by the fishermen in these huge nets to all swim down and as a group to break free of the hunter's nets. And so it becomes a parable about the many against the predatory humans. It becomes a parable about this loopy sense of time that Dory represents. It becomes a parable about queer family. It becomes a parable about disability, because Nemo has a little fin, a disabled fin. And despite his physical disabilities, he becomes a leader. And beyond that, it's all kinds of things, because, as I say in the book, clownfish are of the fish family that when the female dies, the male transsexes and becomes female. So Marlin is actually a transsexual fish, if you choose to read the film that way. So you have everything in there, everything. And it seems like it's just another story of family. But when you examine it closely, it conforms to this narrative format that I outline in the book of having a kind of anarchistic principle, a notion of community and cooperation, and a resistance to the nuclear family as the only way of having bonds of belonging and intimacy.
And something else that comes up so interestingly in your discussion of Finding Nemo is also this kind of temporal implication, temporal aspect, particularly around the character of Dory, and I think you have a chapter that's subtitled something like Stupidity and Forgetting or something like that.
Yeah.
But there's an interesting discussion there, not just about the community versus the individual or the community versus the heteronormative family, but also about the generationality, if you will, of the family versus what happens when forgetting is a big part of the story.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, the feature that makes Dory stand out as loopy and queer and different is that she can't remember anything for more than a few minutes. And this makes her seem stupid, when in fact it just gives her a different orientation, a phenomenologist would say, a different orientation to the world, and one that is, it's like our computers, it's being constantly updated. And in the process of updating, it gives up memory in order to renew itself. And so Dory lives in the eternal present. And there are lots of political movements, including the Situationists from the 1960s, who advocated for a sort of eternal present within which we keep making the world anew, rather than being tethered and tied and bound to the traditions of the past that keep us in the business of reproducing the old. So unfortunately, in academia, because of certain kinds of disciplinary formulaic thinking, we tend to think of forgetting and memory in opposition to each other, where memory is the good thing that we must do, and forgetting is the bad thing that official regimes tend to do to cover up their own crimes. But there is no fixed quality or value to memory and forgetting. And memory and forgetting can be conservative or radical in different ways. So one of the things that I explore in the book is the power of forgetfulness, if what we want is to advocate for and spur transformation and renewal. And so that I have a number of examples, Dory being the paradigmatic one, of a creature who forgets, because she forgets, is able to access knowledge in a different way. And as I point out, you know, Dory knows a lot of things. She can read human language. She speaks whale. She navigates her way across the Pacific. She doesn't remember who she is from one minute to the next, but she's freed up from family bonds. She has to keep making her relations to the world and to other creatures again and again. And she's always curious and pleasantly surprised by the world. And there's a real lesson in there about, you know, the importance of surprise and of seeing things differently, by waking up to them as if for the first time. And so then I look at a whole bunch of movies within which memory and forgetting are central, and forgetting becomes the loss of identity, for example, in films like Memento, or becomes associated with brainwashing in other films that, you know, are about sort of American soldiers who are being captured, the Manchurian candidate, for example, captured and then brainwashed. But memory can also be a very disciplinary thing that forces you to think about the past, but only in certain ways and only in relationship to certain narratives. Forgetfulness, as Nietzsche said, is important and necessary to every human being in order for there to be such a thing as happiness in the first place. So I'm a big advocate for looking at forgetfulness in terms of its potentiality, its potential for disruption, and therefore for the production of new narratives.
You draw a distinction, though, or maybe not a sharp distinction, but you talk about a sort of a range of kind of filmic portrayals of forgetfulness, some of which you prefer perhaps as more queering, right, of a mainstream project, and some of which you find, in fact, in the end, reinforcing heteronormativity or patriarchy. Mm-hmm. What makes one form of forgetting queer and one form of and other forms of forgetting not as challenging?
Yeah. Well, some forms of forgetting that are allied with a more conservative project forget only in order to continue on with the same. You know, so you could give all kinds of political examples of, you know, the U.S. Backing a kind of fascist government in one moment and then condemning it in the next, backing Saddam Hussein in one era and then in the next, invading and removing him from power. The U.S. national memory is full of these erasures and renewal that indicate a conservative project within which the nation only wants to remember events according to the latest version of power in history. And so one has to be very careful about the claims that one makes for forgetting, precisely because forgetting has a clear ideological value to regimes that want to cover up their bad deeds. So forgetting of the queer variety has more of a micro quality to it. It's a kind of forgetfulness that stalls the imposition of the norm and refuses to renew the status quo in the same place. And, you know, in a way, this is a kind of a psychoanalytic argument that I make about refusing to, in a way, the ways in which the norm is very invested in memory and the memory that is passed on to you by your parents. But because the queer represents a break in the renewal of the family, then the queer person has an opportunity to forget and to go on differently. And I'm not saying that that opportunity is always taken or always queer. And I give examples in the book of forgetting that's important in different ways. And the best example is in Toni Morrison's famous novel, Beloved, where the Seth A character wants to forget because the memories of slavery hold her in time and place and bind her to a particular model of terror that won't let her go. So there's that. There's the example of a kind of post-colonial forgetting that can be very radical, where the colonized subject refuses to acquiesce to the colonial rule and forgets to be a colonized subject and represses and refuses to be a self, if you like. So I'm trying to sort through all of the different valences of forgetfulness without simply consigning it to the other, to the benefits of remembering. And there, again, this is a kind of, it's an academic tick to invest in all these memory projects while not seeing that forgetfulness and the erasure of certain narratives is just as important.
You know, you're bringing us to some of the texts that you look at in the second half of the book, where you're encountering, in this case, for example, examples of forgetting that you see as very useful and very important in escaping slavery and escaping colonialism. But still, there's something much more somber about this discussion.
Yeah.
You use the term politics of refusal, mm-hmm. in some of this discussion, not only as a kind of a challenge to memories that can be debilitating, like the ones we just talked about, but also as in some cases a sort of a challenge to what you see as a common feminist celebration of the mother-daughter trajectory. Mm. So you do have a critique here of a certain kind of feminist discourse.
Yes, I do. I do. And that's, you know, and that's a hard one, because here I am every day in the classroom teaching feminism to reluctant young women and men and advocating for it. But at the same time, you know, I've moved through different forms, different iterations of feminism, some of which have been utterly liberating and some of which have been incredibly suffocating. But I came to be a feminist in the era where Judith Butler's work began to have its impact. And the reason that that kind of work was so important to me was because of the question mark that it placed alongside the category of woman. And because it asked that pertinent question that she asked in Gender Trouble about who exactly is this subject, woman, for whom feminism is organized. And there are, you know, a lot of my work has followed on from that insight by saying actually the category of woman is internally divided in all kinds of ways, and some of which result in transgender identification, some of which are about female masculinity and so on. But in this book, I become interested in forms of feminine being that, again, intuitively we have shied away from passivity and masochism, but that counterintuitively offer us different insights into the gendered condition. And so, you know, I'm falling on from what I see as a post-structuralist and post-colonial kind of tradition of feminism that doesn't ask about how we become women, but asks about how we unbecome women. How can we fail to be women in the way that the culture has classified woman? You know, I find pieces of this project all over the place and have to be forgiven for making very, sometimes seemingly random associations, grabbing from Monique Fatigue here, from Jamaica Kincaid there, from Saidiya Hartman, from Gayatri Spivak, Sabah Mahmood, as well as Butler, Yoko Ono. But what I'm trying to find is a less orderly tradition of feminism that doesn't culminate in a heroic project. And as you say, this is the part of the book where things become much darker, because there is a dark side to failure. And one of the things that failure asks us to think about as humans is why we're so invested in these heroic narratives of the human, even in the identitarian narratives of resistance that we tell, when in fact, maybe the one thing that people share as humans is a capacity to fail. And that means a relationship to a much darker set of principles that have to do with, being fragmented and not feeling oneself to be in control, being an unmastering subject, somebody who is lost, someone who can't become, and someone who doesn't know, most importantly, who isn't always in control of knowledge. And it's that. So, you know, a part way through the book, we move from saying, wow, how amazing, there's an alternative to the hegemony of success that's embedded in failure, to a recognition that that alternative can't now re-establish itself in the same terrain that we just critiqued in relationship to success. So failure can't take up, it can't put up its flag on the territory of becoming and being and surmounting and mastering. It has to reconcile itself to unmastering, unbecoming, undoing, losing, fragmenting, failing, and those kinds of things.
And like you say, some of this, it feels initially very counterintuitive, right? Yeah. How can you build something on unbuilding, right?
Yeah.
And I wonder if you can maybe, again, walk us through an example.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of your artists, how does this work?
Well, I'll give two examples. So the example that I first came to was when I came across it when I went to the big feminist art retrospective that was held here in LA in like 2005, the WAC show, maybe 2006. And at the WAC show, they collected all of this brilliant art by women and feminists from the 1970s and put it all in a big warehouse space, at which point it sort of, the art chattered across the walls to each other. And I was moving through the space and there was all kinds of stuff on the walls, you know, very female body-centric art, the paintings, there was lots of abstraction, there was Carol Schneeman pulling, you know, scrolls from her vagina, there was all kinds of performance stuff. And then in the corner of the one of the corners of the warehouse, I came to the video section where I found a little room with Yoko Ono's cut piece in it, which I had read about but I had never seen. So I sit down to watch this 8-minute piece of Yoko Ono in 1964 getting up on a stage, putting a pair of scissors in front of her and inviting the audience to come and cut pieces of her clothing off. And I had read Julia Bryan Wilson's really definitive essay on it, on the piece, but I found myself sort of disagreeing with her quick dismissal of the masochism of the piece. And in fact, I wanted to know what the masochism was doing. What does it mean for an Asian woman to place herself at the disposal of a white audience in 1964 in the U.S.? And what happens when 6.5 minutes in, a white guy jumps up and really starts just like cutting her clothing off in quite an aggressive way? And what I wanted to do was a reading of the piece that made use of the passivity and the masochism that she demonstrates, that engages with the rigor and the discipline of sitting still for 8 minutes while people cut your clothing off, and that then reflects upon the meaning of this act in the realm of feminism. And that's sort of what began me on this, like, well, maybe there's something more going on with passivity and masochism than we're allowing for. Maybe passivity and refusal and staying still in the end are much more effective in terms of a politics of refusal than agitation and yelling and exhorting people to become themselves. Maybe there's a way in which that just bolsters the sort of liberal notion of subjecthood, whereas this quietly undoes it. So that would be the main example. And then there's a lot of queer art that I go to as well in the feminism and the queer art chapter, some of which came to me very late in the project. And it's a friend of mine in LA, Monica Maioli, who does these paintings of her ex-lovers, where she takes pictures of them in a dark mirror and then paints their outline. And those paintings are, they're dark, literally dark. So they're actually very difficult to reproduce, but they're also a kind of an homage to loss, to the impossibility of love. And this kind of counteracts a whole long tradition of lesbian art making that has been about being legitimate and recognizable and refusing to see lesbianism as the place of impossibility and instead making lesbianism into something joyous and pleasurable. And these paintings say, yeah, but at the end of the day, lesbians have the same relationship to loss that everybody else does, and I want to paint that too. So there are a number of, I have a ton of work that I try to use, not simply as illustrations, but to find the kind of theoretical material that led me back to passivity and masochism in the first place.
Yeah, I'd be interested in hearing you talk a little bit more about the, again, we're moving now to some of the queer art, and you do also, in a sense, take on what you see as a kind of a celebratory queer studies, queer identity. You talk about what you call the canonical queer archive, right? Of style and wit and all these things. And you produce a kind of an alternative archive of antisocial queers. And first of all, tell us about that canonical archive. Who's in it? Why are they there? What's the problem with it?
Yeah.
And what's your alternative archive?
Well, I think we all have alternative archives, and the whole high versus low culture split was designed to allow for these, you know, other materials to become the vehicles for theorizing culture and so on. So I think I don't try to make canonical my low archive so much as to say, well, depending on our project, we're going to need different archives. But I was, you know, and this is my grouchy side. I was really getting irritated by the way in which a particular gay male archive stood in for all of queer culture. And there were a couple of different things that that motivated this. One was when I was at a queer conference in London, and I was on a panel with Michael Warner, and he gave what was a very nice paper, actually, on glamour and counter-glamour. And we all know almost intuitively that glamour is a gay male thing, and that glamour has been produced and orchestrated and choreographed by gay men for the culture at large, whether in relationship to fashion or arts or style. But then he wanted to say his example of counter-glamour was also gay male. And I was just like, I don't think so. I don't think that we want to fill up all available registers with just gay male examples. Like, there are lots and lots of examples of counter-glamour that we would call lesbian. And all you have to think about is that recent Bridesmaids film where the sort of dykey character who also turned out to be a sort of, a voracious man killer. I can't remember the actress who plays her, but she's nominated for an Oscar this year. Melissa McCarthy, I think. She is a kind of unglamour. She represents unglamour. And so what I wanted to say was, why? Why is the archive of the canon gay male and the counter archive is gay male? Why are we so satisfied with a rather narrow swathe of culture for everything that we want to talk about in queer studies? And this does have to do with the fact that queer studies had one of its origin points in English departments, and with that sort of, typical, wonderful Sedgwickian insight that the canon is already gay and it's full of gay male writers, Oscar Wilde, E.M. Forster, Henry James, etc. So, okay. So what I would then, when I read Lee Edelman's work and became really, really interested in the antisocial thesis as he developed it from Bassani, I was like, well, okay, so you're kind of arguing the opposite of all of these folks who want to restore gay male work to its proper place in the pantheon, but you're still using the same work. What happens if, in order to trace this strand of negativity that we're associating with the queer, maybe we have to abandon that canon and come up with another one? So instead of Alfred Hitchcock, why not Patricia Highsmith? Instead of Oscar Wilde, what happens if you go to Gertrude Stein or Radcliffe Hall, or all of that middle brow work that is seen as peculiarly lesbian and so on? And I have a long list of people who I'm not trying to put in a new canon. I'm trying to use to rupture the whole idea of sticking with the same canon over and over again. And other examples of this are Jack Smith in some people's counter canons. He comes up over and over again, and he becomes sort of the king of failure, if you like. And Andy Warhol, of course, for countless gay male projects, Andy Warhol, it serves this ground. I also was trying to suggest that gay male criticism would be immeasurably improved if it wasn't only about men in relationship to queerness, but managed to include stuff by people who have lived in non-male bodies, and that this would change the kinds of arguments that people were going to have to make.
So what does happen once we pull these other people into the conversation?
Well, what happens is that then when you want to do a critique of something like mastery, you're making that critique in relationship to a body that was not ever in a position of mastery, potentially. So, it makes a big difference to argue about becoming self-shattering, to use Bassani's terms, for example. It makes a big difference if you talk about self-shattering in a gay male body or in a female body. And a lot of these gay men who want to talk about the destructive and shattering power of sexuality still stick with a male body that has access to privilege that it renounces. But what about the female body in all of this that doesn't have the same access to mastery in the first place? How then does this notion of self-shattering or fragmentation play itself out? And we get much closer to the realm of the abject that Bassani and Edelman seem to want to write about if we go through one of these already abject bodies, rather than through a body that seems perfect but gives up its stake in perfection.
And you have just this very interesting discussion of this striking image of Gertrude Stein, for example, a double image.
Yeah.
You know, of course, looking very butch as she does, but of course she can't achieve masculinity.
That's right.
Because in the end, she is in a female body.
Yeah.
So it's you know, between the visuals and the discussion of it, it's really very striking set of things to think about.
Yeah.
You also have this, I just wanted to ask you about your discussion of, you have this neat discussion of physical spaces of emptiness, some photographs of empty swimming pools,
yeah,
for example, empty bars that are just so visually striking.
Yeah.
But again, in thinking about failure and emptiness and loss, I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, I, in keeping with some of the work that I'd done in my previous book, In a Queer Time and Space, I didn't want everything to be about, in terms of the art that I was talking about, I wasn't satisfied with all queerness running through art that is fixed on figuration and a body. Like, you know, why does queer art require a body, but heterosexual art doesn't? And, you know, obviously we see Jackson Pollock as a very heterosexual painter because we understand this act of sort of splattering paint on a canvas to be somehow equivalent to a sort of masturbatory excess. And we have no problem reading heterosexuality into the gesture, into the art, and so on. But what I was finding when I was beginning to think about queer art practices was how stuck queer art history is on a body, particularly again on the male body. And there are whole books that, you know, that are unable really to get beyond the notion of queer art demanding a figure that is readably queer. And, you know, if you take somebody like Richard Meyer's work, I mean, he writes about Warhol and Cadmus and Mapplethorpe, all of whom are artists who, you know, revolve around faces and bodies and so on. So, again, in this, I wanted to really learn from my own earlier writing about the importance of looking at abstraction as well and finding queer echoes and resonances in abstract work. And even though the swimming pools and the rooms are not abstract, they are abstract representations of queerness. And they tell us that by queer artists, Cabero y Casella, Spanish duo who work together, and they are representing something about their experience through the empty pools and the empty bars, about the relationship that a lot of queer culture has to loss, that has to not having a space, not being in relationship to space, and not being in relationship to abundance. So it was really an attempt to say, the queer art of failure, as I am documenting it in this chapter, isn't exhausted by the figure or the odd figure, the queer figure, but also needs to be read into all of these different representations of space, spatiality, emptiness, and so on, as you're saying.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating to read that discussion. I want to make sure we have time to talk about your last big section,
yeah,
on homosexuality and fascism.
Right.
Introduce us to that topic. Tell us what you're doing in that chapter.
Well, I was quite influenced by work by Dagmar Herzog, and I had started reading about sexuality and fascism, just in a sort of out of my own sense of curiosity. And like many people, I was very influenced by that early Susan Sontag essay on the fascination of fascism, but felt that there was something sort of vaguely homophobic in her discussion at the end of the way in which the paraphernalia and the fetishistic material of fascism had now moved away from the scene of fascism itself, but made its reappearance in the sort of theatricality of gay male sex cultures. And I still think there is something sort of homophobic there, but in keeping with my book's theme of being willing to go into discussions that other people find unsavory and distasteful, I also was wanting to investigate what that endless connection that people want to make between fascism and homosexuality was all about. And it didn't seem to me that it was as simple as homophobia. It is true that to, you know, in some way to call fascism, to somehow essentially connect it to homosexuality is homophobic, because it is just as essentially connected to certain toxic forms of heterosexuality. But it is not the case that there is no connection between homosexuality and fascism, particularly when we're talking about early forms of the gay emancipation movement in pre-Nazi Germany and their emphasis on masculinity and a sort of, you know, male society of men and boys. So I decided to take a bit of a risk in that chapter and push a little bit further beyond what, say, someone like Dagmar Hertzog had done, by saying, if it is the case that, as she argues, that the Nazis were opportunistic in their relationship to material on sexuality, sometimes being moralistic, sometimes not, sometimes making a nod to Catholicism, sometimes not, sometimes advocating for certain forms of sexual morality, sometimes being very loose about that, then that must be true in relationship to homosexuality as well as heterosexuality. And that became the jumping off point for the book. The few times that I did present it, I did always have somebody in the audience who accused me of like not knowing what I was doing and of being homophobic and of sort of, you know, really saying to me, like, why would you want to do this? Why would you want to pursue this connection when it's so clearly a homophobic one and and one that cannot benefit anyone? And my point is that why I would respond, why do we want to clean up gay and lesbian history so that it just becomes a series of stepping stones where we hopscotch from one heroic event or act of resistance to another and we skirt the material that we don't like? That's not history. That's, you know, wishful thinking. And in order to be really committed to this project of failure and loss and anti-heroic narratives, then one has to go into the material that feels dangerous. And I had a feeling that it was a sort of dangerous chapter.
It does feel dangerous, and you have this very interesting discussion, not only of course, the material itself and how the area of gay and lesbian studies has traditionally dealt with the Third Reich, which is, of course, to emphasize the ways in which gay men and lesbians were, in many cases, victimized, and to be very nervous about the subject of homoeroticism within the movement, which, of course, did exist. There's no question about it. But I was also struck by this topic of discomfort with particularly with Collier Shore. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing the name of the photographer right. Tell us a little bit about that person's work, because this is someone who is literally putting photographic subjects into uncomfortable situations in a way to try to pry at that discomfort with the past, with that particular past.
And Collier, I was drawn, someone had told me about Collier's work a long time ago. And I did some research and found out that she was, you know, a Jewish butch lesbian photographer living in New York City and had a Jewish German past and had gone and lived in Germany for a while and was very drawn to taking pictures of German boys doing boyish things, playing war games. And one day decided to, you know, dress the boys that she was photographing up in army uniforms and went through a series of uniforms and then asked them to get dressed up in sometimes in just German uniforms, sometimes actually in what she could recreate of SS uniforms. And she then wrote in a few different places and was interviewed about how uncomfortable this made everybody in the small town in southern Germany where she was taking these photographs. She talked about the mix of sort of melancholy, regret, horror, and disavowal that the older generation expressed when they saw these young blonde men in these uniforms again. And she wanted to just kind of create a visual archive in a way that she knew would be completely taboo for any German to try to create. And I think it was a kind of a desire for there to be a record, for there to not just for us not to just disappear the material that is become so repellent with hindsight, but to remind us of it. And not, she didn't really know what was going to happen when she took these pictures and circulated them. But what she did say, which I found really interesting, was that the young men were really excited when they were wearing like American uniforms, but they became visibly uncomfortable in the Nazi uniforms, even though, of course, if they were going to, reach back into the past, their national past, that would have been a typical uniform for them to gravitate towards. Were history different? And I think that relates to my wanting to say, look, as gays and lesbians, we also have to find those images of gay men and lesbians who participated in the Nazi regime rather than simply being victims of it. And I don't know if you remember, but there was a film came out in like 2003, I think, Aimé and Jaguar. Mm-hmm. And yeah. It was a crazy film from a very crazy memoir of a German woman who had taken a Jewish woman as her lover during the war and then tried to hide her a little bit. But eventually the woman got picked up and was sent to a camp and died. And later on, the Berlin lesbian community wanted to honor this German woman who had been married to a Nazi officer who was not a hero in any way, and who, where it wasn't clear what her role was in this Jewish woman actually being picked up by the police. They wanted to turn her into a hero because she was a lesbian who had been around in World War II and had had a relationship with a Jewish woman. And I thought it was just such an ignorant way of being in relationship to such a complicated piece of history, of their history. And I wanted to, say, well, it would be one thing to try to remember this Jewish woman, but it's another thing to exonerate this German woman, this wife of a Nazi officer, for all of her participation in the Nazi regime, and exonerate her because she was a lesbian. It just seems so ridiculous to me. So we have to look at these examples, and we have to be in relationship to them too, I guess is what I was trying to say. You can't just be in relationship to the gays and lesbians who suffered in World War II. There were lots of men in the German army who were quite happy to be in the German army and go undercover.
So it's a real challenge, right, to gay history, to queer studies, to deal with the uncomfortable. Let me just close by asking you what you're working on now. What can we expect?
Yes. So, I had been toying anyway, even before I did that chapter on homosexuality and fascism, I had been sort of interested in thinking about the relationship between fascism and sexuality on the one hand, but also trying to get at some of the material on the Holocaust that I was interested in through my father's experience as a kinder transport refugee. And it's a tough project for me. It sort of goes in a very different direction than anything I've done before. And so I'm sort of working my way through some of the material on child survivors and refugees, but also still asking these sort of impertinent questions about sexuality and fascism. And I'm not yet sure how all of this material will come together in a book. But I'm interested in trying to push away from some of the very conventional Holocaust studies material that I've been reading. Trying to do a more interdisciplinary project around beginning with the kinder transport and moving on from there. In the meantime, I have another book, though, coming out, a very different book coming out from Beacon in the fall called Gaga Feminism, Sex, Gender, and the End of Normal. And that's more a fun book about what is feminism now that's written for a popular audience. So those are the two projects that I've been working on.
That's terrific. We have a lot to look forward to read. Wonderful. This has been fascinating, Jack. I'm so glad we had you on the show.
Thanks. Such great and perceptive questions. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, I really look forward to reading more. And thanks for talking to us today.
Great. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We've just been talking to Judith Halberstam, author of The Queer Art of Failure, which appeared in 2011 with Duke University Press. I'm Lisa Heineman, co-host of New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies, part of the New Books Network. Thanks for being with us.